This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show today, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manessa Sogavare faces a vote of no confidence. Very soon, our reporter Evan Wasuka will join me for an update on that situation in Souls. Also, this week, New Caledonia will, for the third and final time, vote on whether it should become independent from France.
It is perceived by the Kanak people that the French are not respecting aspects of their cultural identity.
But there has been a push from Kanak leaders to postpone the poll. An explainer on that situation coming up in about 20 minutes. And a rugby revolution in Melbourne. The Rebels Super W team are set to become the first women's side to be paid when their season starts next year.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
First, though, all eyes are on Solomon Islands today, where members of Parliament will decide whether Manessa Sogavare will continue as Prime Minister. There are real fears the vote of no confidence lodged by opposition leader Matthew Wale could reignite protests and rioting in the country. The Royal Solomon Islands Police Force have warned they won't hesitate to make arrests over inflammatory posts on social media. Port Honiara has been declared a maritime emergency zone, restricting all movement of vessels, and the Premier of Malaita Province, Daniel Suidani, says independence could be an option if the desired outcome isn't seen.
Australia and the regional partners need to listen to our voice within Solomon Islands and not only from the government. If there is no chance after the motion of no confidence, Malaita province and its people will have to look deeper to see whether staying with Solomon Island is worthy of anything at all.
Meanwhile, the Chinese embassy in Solomon Islands is warning nationals of potential security risks after many were left homeless and distressed in the recent riots. And The Australian is reporting that Chinese money is being used to sway votes for the Prime Minister. And it also doesn't look like it's a happy camp with the regional peacekeeping mission from Australia, PNG, Fiji and New Zealand either, with PNG forces rejecting a request to operate under Australia, saying they'll operate under the Solomon Islands Police Force instead. Now, joining me to talk about the situation on the ground in Honiara is ABC reporter Evan Wasuka. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Jordan.
Evan, how are people feeling today ahead of the motion of no confidence?
Well, Jordan, it's been pretty calm over the last couple of days, and the security situation here has really settled with the peacekeepers from Australia and Fiji and PNG moving around in the community. But there's still a lot of unease about today's motion of no confidence, which the MPs will decide on whether Prime Minister Manessa Sogavare will stay. Even in the city centre where I am right now, shipping containers have been pushed into place to block off the ports area. Some of the shops, there's been shipping containers are lined up in front of them. So people are concerned, and it's a bit lots of uneasiness and a bit of tension as we look towards this motion of confidence. Over the weekend, we saw people from the Western Province, a lot of them started heading back to their province on ships that were available on Sunday. So the port area was quite full. People are wondering what will be the outcome of today's motion and what that means, given that protesters and the rioters want the Prime Minister to step down. What will happen if he wins? So there's lots of uneasiness and lots of questions in the air. But people are thankful that the peacekeepers are here, and hopefully their presence will mean that today's motion will have a peaceful outcome.
And there's been quite a bit of speculation about how today could play out. What's likely to happen today? Can you take us through what the day could look like?
So Parliament's scheduled to meet at 9:30 today. What will happen is when the MPs arrive, they'll go into Parliament, the session will start. It's basically an open floor where members will start to debate about this motion of no confidence against the Prime Minister, Manessa Sogavare. I think what we'll see is members of Parliament, especially those from Malaita, will be given a chance to air their views. And this is something that the public will be listening in on, and they know their voters will be listening in on. We know that in Malaita province, The premier is organizing people to go to the market in Auki town, which is the capital there, to listen in on the debate. So all ears will be on what's happening on the floor of parliament. And we really don't know in terms of the numbers where the allegiances lie right now. But definitely people would be keen to hear what the MPs have to say and where they stand, whether they're back with Sogovare or whether they're calling for change. So it's likely to be a long day today.
And on those numbers, Manessa Sogovare has been Prime Minister four times now. What is his future looking like and his chances of winning this motion today?
In terms of numbers, if you look last week, he still had the support of the majority of MPs. He lost three MPs. They resigned from his party after the rioting. The numbers are still in his favour. And going into today, we haven't seen any more resignations. And that's the key thing. The resignations indicate who's left and who's moving. But having said that, it's still going to be pretty fluid. We don't know what's going to happen until the MPs cast their votes. And that will come by sometime in the afternoon. And that's when we'll see what will happen in terms of the voting today. He just needs 25 MPs to keep his position.
And if he does win, what happens next?
Well, yeah, that's the big question. We know in Malaita province, we heard from Daniel Sridani earlier, there's been talks about independence if Sogovare wins the motion today. I've been told what's likely to happen is that there'll be like an announcement on a pathway towards independence. So there could be, if Sogovare wins, there could be something from Malaita about this is what we're going to do to get towards independence rather than all-out declaration of independence. So that could happen, but that would only come into, could be triggered if Sogovare wins the motion later today.
And regardless of the result of today's motion of no confidence, in this particular situation where there is, as you say, that atmosphere of unease and so much tension, what do you think needs to happen to resolve it all?
Well, there's been calls right throughout the past week for dialogue to happen between Malaita province and the national government, between Sogovare and the Premier Sridani and the opposition leader. We haven't seen any of that happen. Both sides leading up to the motion today have really just held their position really strongly. None of them have moved closer towards the middle ground. Certainly after this motion, something needs to happen in terms of a dialogue between the different parties. Now, the Guadalcanal Premier has offered to mediate between the different parties. The Solomon Islands Christian Association, SICA, they've also offered up the Archbishop, the largest church in the Solomons, to be the mediator between the different grouping. So there are lots of calls for dialogue, and I think that's probably what needs to happen soon after this motion today.
Well, still lots to see what will come of later today. But Evan Wasuka, you'll be across all of it, of course. We'll check in with you later in the afternoon. But thank you for bringing us those updates.
Thank you, Jordan.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. And a question for you. How would you feel if your bank was loaning money to companies that have faced accusations of illegal logging? That's a question particularly for people in Papua New Guinea, with a new report finding that commercial banks have given hundreds of millions of kina to the country's largest exporters of tropical logs over the past two decades. And that's prompting calls for the banks to divest from the logging sector, as Marion Farr reports.
Papua New Guinea's rainforests are some of the largest and most biodiverse in the world.
These forests and the biodiversity that they protect are part of the production mechanism of oxygen.
They're important for wildlife and also for the climate.
They sequester carbon and they store this carbon, and now with issues to do with climate change, global warming, etc., etc., becoming more and more urgent, we have to pay attention.
The governor of Oro province, Gary Juffa, says protecting these natural assets is a priority.
I know for a fact that there are illegal logging activities taking place in the whole country. You know, my province itself is plagued with illegal logging activities. I'm in court over these matters.
While there's been a focus on legislation and the activity of logging companies themselves, attention is now turning to banks. A report by the advocacy organisation Act Now and NGO Jubilee Australia Research Centre looks into the financing relationships between banks and PNG's timber industry. It found that since the year 2000, PNG's banking sector has provided at least 300 million kina to logging companies. That's 120 million Australian dollars. The report also claims banks are at risk of being complicit in illegal activity associated with the sector. For Gary Juffa, that's concerning.
These companies would have to put their money somewhere or bank their money somewhere. They would have to transfer that money out or use it to pay bills or other transactions, etc. So obviously it would be going through the banking system. And then if a bank were to take those proceeds and then basically store it, use it, whatever, allow it to be transacted through its institution, then that bank is complicit or is in some way or another corroborating or aiding and abetting in the commission of these crimes.
The Act Now report focused on four major banks operating in PNG: BSP, Kina Bank, Westpac and ANZ. While BSP's policies consider logging from unsustainably managed forests to be an excluded sector, the report found it was still providing finance to logging giant Rimbunan Hijau, which operates subsidiaries in PNG. Those subsidiaries, the report says, have been implicated in allegations of police violence against landowners and environmental destruction. And it claims satellite images have shown one of the subsidiaries cutting down trees in areas where they're not legally allowed to harvest. Rimbunan Hijau has publicly rejected these allegations, saying it abides by all relevant laws and regulations and takes environmental regulations seriously. Kina Bank told the report authors it didn't have a financial relationship with Rimbunan Hijau, but the bank hasn't given a clear answer as to whether it is giving loans to other logging companies. Rimbunan Hijau, Kina Bank and BSP have not responded to the ABC's request for comment. But Gary Juffa says they should be paying more attention.
We can't ignore the fact that the rest of the world is now watching and concerned about deforestation, illegal logging and these type of activities.
And what about Westpac and ANZ? According to the report, the two Australian-owned banks only finance logging companies with FSC or PEFC certification. That's the global system that certifies wood from well-managed or sustainable forests. Westpac told the ABC it's reviewed its customer base and has closed the accounts of any customers without these certifications. But environmental scientist Professor Bill Lawrence says that doesn't get the banks off the hook.
The FSC, some people think relatively highly of it. It also has many critics. The PEFC actually came out of Indonesia originally, if I've got that right, and it's not nearly as well respected. And so, you know, there's lots and lots of problems that have arisen from that scheme. The fact that Westpac and ANZ are saying, you know, they'll fund people if they've got that PEFC certification, that's concerning, really concerning.
The Act Now report calls on all four banks to divest from PNG's logging industry. As a customer of ANZ himself, that's something Professor Lawrence supports.
You know, the old saying, follow the money. And if the finance isn't there, then that definitely has an impact on the behavior of the loggers and or resource users. There's a lot of stuff happening in PNG. I mean, there's need for reform, you know, across PNG in various ways, in law enforcement, in understanding what's going on. And there is, unfortunately, a lot of hidden activity.
But what do people in PNG think about the issue? We asked a few customers if they were concerned about banks giving loans to logging companies, and the response was mixed.
I bank with BSP Bank since I started employment. But commercial banks, I don't have any issues in them giving credit to companies. But from my own perspective or my own point of view in terms of giving money to these logging companies that are logging our trees but not at the required and right places, I feel it's not right.
I think there's no issue at all with commercial banks providing financial services or access to logging companies. I mean, logging companies are just like every other company.
I think it is still bad practice for banks to be loaning out money to logging companies, especially that amount of money in the millions. I think the real question we should be asking is how much are the landowners benefiting from this?
At the end of the day, Gary Juffa says targeting banks is just one way to address the issue.
There are many ways you can deal with it. One way is that. The other way is to just, you know, enforce the laws. I mean, for instance, many of these logging companies keep breaching their permit and licensing requirements, and they're just given a slap on the wrist, some tiny little fine, and then they're allowed to continue.
Governor of Oro Province, Gary Jufa, ending Marion Farr's report with additional reporting by Belinda Cora. Time now to get a wrap of news-making headlines around the region this morning. I'm joined by reporter Talia Olatia. Good morning, Talia.
Hello, Jordan.
Tali, some interesting fun facts, though, first, just on that song we were listening to, which was by Te Waka, Laka Laka. Yes. You were telling me off-air that that actually was part of the inspiration for the Moana film.
Yes, well, and most of the Te Waka songs are. That's literally how Disney found Opetaia Fowai, who, like, is the lead singer of Te Waka as they went through it. And it's funny because when you listen to that song, not only do you hear Olivia Fawai's voice, which is literally the first voice you hear in the movie Moana, but there are parts of it where you're like, oh, that's a part of the soundtrack of Moana, if you've watched it as many times as I have, which I definitely have. Very excited for Moana 2, which also they did this big call out because there's also going to be an animated Moana. So a couple of months ago, they did a call out to artists to contribute their works to Moana, the animation. And so I have just been like on social media to find out if any Pacific artists, because I know that there is one guy in New Zealand, Michelle Mulipola, who is an amazing graphic artist and does a lot of designs with Pacific themes. I know that he submitted. So I'm very interested to see more Pacific collaboration in the next Moana, whatever Moana is. But yes.
When you say animation, do you mean like a TV show?
Yes. Well, it was very under wraps as to what is exactly happening. And of course, when it comes to Disney, they're not just like going like, hey, let me tell you everything that is happening. But yes, yeah, some form of cartoon or something.
That's, I feel like they did that with Lilo and Stitch back in the day. They had the movie and then the TV show as well. Exciting. Yeah.
Just some pop culture.
Just an update on Pacific stuff and Disney as well. Yeah. Let's turn now first to New Caledonia, though. The referendum that is meant to be happening coming up this week on December 12th is being challenged in a Paris court. What's happening?
Yeah, so a group of citizens in New Caledonia are calling on the third and final independence referendum to be postponed. I don't think this part of the news is very new because there's been lots of people calling it for months now. But according to RNZ Pacific, in an urgent submission, 146 voters and three organisations are asking France's highest administrative court to postpone the vote, citing the impact of the pandemic, pretty much saying it's unthinkable that the referendum is going to proceed given what's happening there. So as I said, pro-independence parties had unsuccessfully lobbied Paris to delay the vote and now say they're either not going to take part in it nor actually recognise whatever the result is, saying they will challenge the process at the United Nations. France doesn't seem to be that distracted or dissuaded by these threats because it flew almost 250 magistrates and judicial officials to oversee this Sunday's vote. And they're also flying in about 2,000 extra police, including riot squads, to provide security for the referendum. So, you know, I know we were talking about Solomon Islands just before, but it also sounds like there's going to be drama happening in New Caledonia as well.
Yeah, definitely. And coming up shortly on Pacific Beat, there will be a great explainer from our reporter, Marla Damati, on that situation with the third and final independence vote. Like you say, lots of layers to unpack.
It's like an onion.
Like an onion, unpeeling, in this week leading up to December 12th. Let's turn now to Vanuatu, though, because they've received a high happiness ranking.
Yeah, this was a happy story, and I don't think we have a lot of them around, so I always try and grab them when I can see them. The Vanuatu Daily Post is reporting that Vanuatu ranked second on the Happy Planet Index, coming in behind Costa Rica out of 150 countries. This is the third time Vanuatu has ranked in the top five countries in the Happy Planet Index since it was first published in 2006. Vanuatu is actually the only Pacific country listed in this index, which is largely a result of a lack of well-being data available being in the region. But it is good to see that the one Pacific country that is representing pretty well.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I love that there is a Happy Planet Index just going around figuring out where the happiest places are. Okay, let's turn now to some sports news. The Fijiana are continuing to go from strength to strength.
Yeah, indeed. It's been a good year for the Fijiana Rugby Sevens team, who continue to impress fans and are currently in second place in the World's Women's Sevens Series after reaching their second final yesterday morning. For the second time in a week, Australia was just too strong in the final, this time beating the Fijiana 15-5. But it really is a story of a team that can, and they, like you said, they really are going from strength to strength. Meanwhile, the Fiji's men's sevens side isn't having the tournament they wanted. They're in sixth place with 23 points in the men's sevens series standing. South Africa leads with 44 points, followed by Argentina and then Australia. And then the next leg of the sevens series will be played in Spain next month. So more rugby sevens to come.
The women coming in strong. I'm sure many Fijiana fans very happy.
I mean, after the Olympics, and now they're just continuing
just that
their
momentum.
Run. Yeah, exactly.
We'd love
really,
to see it.
It's really the team that just runs on an oily rag, and the fact that they are second in the world at this sport is incredible.
Pretty spectacular. Finally, Tali, a story that you've got for me that proves that honesty is rewarded.
Yes, that's right. Listeners will know that we love an art crime story. And so when I produce for you in the morning, I always try to involve something that involves art and crime. But this one is the opposite, because this one is about honesty and art. Well, not really art. Anyway, the BBC is reporting that a climber on Mont Blanc in the French Alps, who stumbled upon a treasure trove of emerald rubies and sapphires that had lain hidden for decades, has been allowed to keep the treasure for himself. The mountaineer, who has not been named, discovered the precious stones in a box 8 years ago in 2013 while on Mont Blanc. He handed it over to the police, which is required by French law, and was really praised at the time for his integrity and honesty. Officials believe that they may have belonged these jewels to an unidentified passenger on board an Air India flight from Mumbai to New York, which crashed into the mountain in 1996. And unfortunately, all 117 people on board died. So after an unsuccessful attempt to locate the family of the owner in India so they could be reunited with these jewels, what happened was the mountaineer was rewarded with half of the trove of the hundreds of precious stones, and the local authority, Chamonix, which I should have Googled how to pronounce earlier, did not. So apologies to anyone who can speak French, taking the other half. So the gems in two equal lots have been valued at just under $250,000 Australian dollars.
Wow.
So, you know, they say crime doesn't pay, but honesty does. So if you ever find anything, just make sure that you hand it over to the police. And there is a law here in Australia, don't quote me, but if you do find something and you take it to the police and after an amount of time it hasn't been claimed, it does actually get given back to the person who found
it. There you go. So maybe we should go climbing in the mountains.
Yes. Or, like, I also know that because once I think I found like a $50 note and I handed it into work. This is when I used to work at Kmart, who then it wasn't from our banks, like our money. Like, we didn't lose it from a register or anything.
Yeah.
Like, our thing's balanced. So then we submitted it to the police to be like, someone dropped $50 in this store, and no one really goes to the police to say, hey, I lost $50. So then it came back to me because I found it.
Look at that.
Honesty.
Honesty is rewarded,
honesty
as you
is
say.
Rewarded. I don't know if that's a law in every country, but honesty always has its own reward. So even if you don't get the money back.
It could just be feeling good on the inside.
Exactly.
For doing something good.
You're doing a good thing for someone else. So anyway.
Moral of the story.
Moral of the story. Be nice to others. Be honest. Be fair.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, yeah. I mean, a great time for that guy who went climbing and stumbled across the jewels.
It would make me go into the wilderness and mountain climb if I knew that, like, there were sapphires and rubies.
And just so fascinating how it got there. When you were telling me that story just then, I was like, maybe did someone have an elaborate treasure hunt planned for someone one time a long time ago?
An elaborate treasure hunt that was worth nearly $500,000.
You hear about these things happening, you don't know.
I want to be friends with you if they're organising $500,000 treasure hunts.
But yeah, wow, amazing. Yes. Charlie, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
The Friday Forum. Two guests, three rules. Rule one, tell us a story that made you angry.
The crisis of governance in PNG's power sector made me feel very disappointed for the many people in Papua New Guinea who have no electricity.
Rule two, what story this week made you feel good?
The Melbourne Rebel teams were able to, first of all, fly out of Victoria, which is grand, and had our first match against the Brumbies.
And rule three, let's lighten up on a Friday. What story made you laugh?
This story couldn't help but make me laugh. Parliament here brought in a special sort of new dress code, and they call it Kia Orana Fridays. Women wearing Rito hats, the men wearing island shirts. There's lots of fresh flower A's.
I would love to come and just smell Parliament because you've made it sound like it smells divine in their fresh florals.
The Friday Forum on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. That's right. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Monday morning. And there is less than a week until the people of New Caledonia vote for a third and final time on the question of whether or not the French territory should become independent. But Indigenous Kanak leaders are calling for the poll to be postponed. And now leaders across the Pacific are also lending their voices to that cause, offering support for the referendum to be delayed because of COVID-19. However, the Pacific Islands Forum has sent a pair of observers to New Caledonia, where they're currently in quarantine. And at this stage, the ballot is still very much going ahead. But how did we even get here? And what lies ahead for New Caledonia? Here's Mala Damati.
Independence Day is a grand celebration each year for Pacific countries like Vanuatu, Fiji and Papua New Guinea, as people around each country reflect on what it means decades after they won independence from their colonial rulers. But the question of independence is still going on in 2021 for New Caledonia. On December 12th, people in the French territory will have their say in the third and final vote on whether they will cut ties with France. That's despite calls from Indigenous Kanak leaders and pro-independence parties to postpone it amid COVID-19 concerns. Key to this referendum and the two others before it is a peace deal called the Noumea Accord. In essence, the agreement made in 1998 was a promise by the French Republic to grant increased political power to New Caledonia and its Kanak population, the Indigenous Melanesians. The accord was signed in early May and recognized for the first time that the Kanak people had been under attack by colonization. It outlined a 20-year transition period before three referenda on self-determination would take place. The Noumea Accord was one of several peace deals over the decades, coming after a bloody conflict that pitted pro-independence groups, French loyalists and the French state against one another.
There was basically a civil war. That term is not used. They use the term in French, événement, the events, or the troubles, les troubles, the disturbances, we would say in English, of the 1970s and 80s over independence. And it was the violence that led to negotiations.
That's Denise Fisher. She was the former Australian Consul General in New Caledonia in the early 2000s and is now a researcher at the Australian National University focusing on France and the South Pacific. She says the initial deal called the 1988 Matignon Accords allowed the Kanak community to be more fully recognised in New Caledonian politics as the territory began its journey towards self-determination.
What was significant about the Matignon Accords was that the Matignon and Oudinot Accords which implemented them, was that it was to put value on particular rights of the Melanesian community, including to fully recognise its cultural identity.
But what the Accords did not foresee was COVID-19. Since the start of the pandemic, New Caledonia has recorded more than 12,000 cases and nearly 280 deaths, most of which have been within the Kanak Indigenous population. In September, Kanak customary authorities declared a 12-month mourning period and called for the vote to be postponed for communities to grieve. But France's High Commissioner to New Caledonia, Premier Patrice Farreau has confirmed the referendum will indeed go ahead. Denise Fisher sees this as one of the reasons for the growing unease in New Caledonia.
Now it is perceived by the Kanak people that the French are not respecting aspects of their cultural identity. So what we can only go to what they themselves have said. When the French decided to go ahead with this date, what has the reaction been? Well, one of the leaders of the independence movement has talked about they were working out a response which will be commensurate with the level of the insult.
Now, Kanak communities and pro-independence parties are calling for non-participation in this vote, which is significant given the outcomes of the previous referenda. The first was held in November 2018, where 56.4% of New Caledonians voted in favour of staying, and that gap narrowed in the second vote held a year ago, when 53% said no to independence and 46% were in favour of it. It is important to note that the three referenda are non-compulsory and people can choose to vote or not. Denise Fisher says it's very uncertain as to how things will play out and whether those in favour of independence will indeed boycott it.
But one of the leaders has said that we have 30,000 young Kanaks. We don't know whether they're going to all obey us. There is some doubt. And looking at the history of New Caledonia, one cannot rule violence out.
So, could France change the date? It is possible. The Nouméa Accord stipulates that the third vote needs to be held by 2022, although a postponement doesn't look likely. But more Pacific leaders are voicing their concerns and are backing calls to defer the referendum, including the former Tuvalu Prime Minister, Enele Sopoanga.
As a leader, a former Prime Minister and a chairman of the Pacific Islands Forum, I strongly believe that we must defer the referendum until perhaps next year, 2022. I believe that given the dynamics now and the situation that is sort of made difficult with this pandemic, the COVID-19, and a lot of tragedy that has happened, particularly affecting the Kanaks community, the indigenous people, it's only right that an opportunity is considered to defer the last and final referendum under the Nouméa Accord.
Mr. Sopoanga is not alone. Vanuatu's Prime Minister has raised his concerns with the French ambassador in Port Vila, and the Melanesian Spearhead Group has also been lobbying to change the date. 64 New Caledonian experts have also written to French newspaper Le Monde, urging Paris to postpone the vote. They say the lead-up evokes the dark hours of Les Eventements of 84 and 88. That's the civil war of the 1980s. So, where to from here? Former Australian Consul General in New Caledonia, Denise Fisher, says it's uncertain.
And in any case, you've got to negotiate how that's going to run with the expiry of the Nouméa Accord. So the key thing is that dialogue needs to take place. So what's the concern here is that not only are the independence leaders flagging that they're not going to participate in the referendum, but they're also raising questions about whether they will participate in discussions about the future. So where to from here is an open question at the moment.
And for former Tuvalu Prime Minister Enele Sopoanga, one thing is clear. If the vote goes ahead as planned on December 12th, he believes that it will hurt France's relationship with the rest of the Pacific.
This is a matter of great importance. And I believe if it didn't fall within the ears of the French leadership, it will certainly impact on the thinking of the countries of the Pacific.
Former Tuvalu Prime Minister Enele Sopoanga, and the reporter there was Mala Damati. Now, in Melbourne, the Rebels Super W team is going to become the first women's side to be paid when their season starts next year. It's a move that seems bound to put pressure on other clubs in the Australian Super W competition to follow suit. And for players in the Pacific, it's a real carrot in terms of there being a paid career path for them to pursue. As Richard Hewitt reports, the Rebels already have a sizable contingent of Pacifica players, but now that there's money on the table, more could follow.
Picking and driving their way ever closer, the Rebels looking to see if they can get in for the first time this match. And they do! The Rebels at their first try.
News that the Rebels Super W players were to be paid in future came at their 2021 awards night, where their captain and Papua New Guinea international Mel Kawa was chosen as player of the season.
It was a historic announcement by the Melbourne Rebels, because Australian women's rugby before that has been completely unpaid. The women's competition at this level has only been around for 5 years. Next year will be the fifth season. And all four seasons before that, they haven't managed to come to an agreement to pay the women. But the Melbourne Rebels, on their own, through a lot of community support and sponsors and partners, just made the decision to pull the trigger and take that obvious next step forward for women in rugby, which is to start recognising them as professional athletes and paying them for up to 20 hours a week that they'll dedicate to the sport. So I'm really stoked that I got to see that within my playing lifetime.
The Rebels coach, Alana Thomas, says there was genuine surprise in the room when the announcement was made.
They were shocked. They were at the end of the speeches and the night going, what does this mean? And for them to be so excited and to see this happening, I can't. It's something that I thought would be in the future, but to have it happening next year is just amazing. For them to be rewarded for all their hard work and sacrifice that they put in is going to be fantastic.
Coach Thomas says the move towards payment has been growing since the control of the team switched from Rugby Victoria to the club itself.
From the moment we came across, there's been an expression from the club that they wanted to pay the players. They wanted to be the first club to do that. That was a priority for them. And pretty much straight away, there was sponsors in the room that said, we want to be a part of this. We want to make sure this happens, and put their hands up. So we've basically got a group of people who have put sponsorship towards it, and the club's gone, no, let's go now. It's a work in progress at the moment for the details, but it's going to happen in 2022, which is really, really exciting.
Mel Kawa says the introduction of payments comes at a time when the number of women playing rugby in the state of Victoria is growing fast.
In Victoria, we have so many new young girls and women trying to take up the sport and trying to represent Melbourne Rebels. So this season, we had 14 new debutante players, and that makes me so proud, because I know that the future is really bright, and the youth coming through means that we're going to have development for the next few years to come.
For women players in or from the Pacific, being paid is considered to be a real landmark. The difference between being able to play rugby at the highest level or not. The Rebels already have a sizeable contingent of Pacifica players, but more may follow now, and there is also a model for the proposed Fijiana Super W side to follow, with negotiations understood to be at an advanced stage.
We've had some girls from Fiji who have come over as a part of their work with church and missions and played for us, so there's definitely opportunities there for players to come and put their hands up to be a part of the Rebels program. And I think this is something that, you know, if we look at the Northern Hemisphere and look at the recent tests and look at what England are doing with their premiership and see the impact it's having over there. If we in Australia and New Zealand even can start to do this, we will see opportunities coming and people from the islands coming and wanting to play and building women's rugby globally, and particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. I think it's just a game changer.
Victoria specifically, and I think even reflected in Rugby Australia, is that the Pacific Islander community make up about 3/4 of the playing community. A lot of players come from Polynesia and Melanesia. They bring a lot of their influence from the islands to the game, and that's seen in their strength, their skill. And in my team, it's about that the same. So I'd say about 2/3 to 3/4 of the team come from Pacific backgrounds. I love seeing that when we have that culture as part of the team, it's a great way to introduce people to your culture, and it breaks down any kind of barriers that you might have had for meeting people like that. We've got girls from Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Samoa and Tonga.
And as an islander herself and captain of the Rebels, Mel Kawa has already demonstrated that she can lead from the front, and now she's been formally recognised for her efforts.
The award that I received was voted by my players and my coaching staff, so I was really honoured and really, really privileged to receive that award. award of Player of the Year. And it was for the 2021 season, which was held in Coffs Harbour this year in between lockdowns. So we were very lucky that we were able to have our season in the first place. And I was really proud to be given that award because I've been at the club now for 2 seasons and as captain. So I really feel like it's a great club to be a part of, and I'm playing some really good rugby.
With the new Super W season still some months away, it's going to be interesting to see how the other franchises react and whether they too can develop payment models.
It could be the difference for players that are weighing up, you know, stepping into that high performance elite environment. There's a lot of training that goes on. There's a lot of time that you put into it. You know, we're training at the moment 3 times a week. We move to 4 times a week in December. Having that financial backing, it means that those decisions of can I go to training and not work that shift becomes an easier decision because they know that they're going to be paid for training and playing, and that doesn't impact then their families. You know, we've got mothers, we've got students, we've got professionals that they have to give up work, they have to give up shifts, they have to give up sometimes financially their jobs to come to training. So this just takes that burden off.
Looking further ahead, the question will be, can elite level rugby match the achievements of Cricket Australia, where women players are now paid on par with the men?
That should be where we're aiming, and look at cricket and what they've done, the way they've been able to grow their profile. They are the benchmark, and it's something that we should be aiming for. And I hope that this is just one step in putting rugby on that journey.
Picked up brilliantly by Collins, and out it goes now to Ratu. What a moment for the 18-year-old Fijian heritage Aon 7 star.
The Melbourne Rebels in action there, action that they will be paid for from next year. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And the former Kiribati president, Anote Tong, wants Australia to adopt a permanent labour program for the Pacific to help resettle people displaced from climate change. It comes ahead of changes to the Australia's Pacific Labour Scheme that promises longer-term visas. But one critic says the new scheme will likely keep labourers in precarious short-term contracts. Mackenzie Smith reports.
Launching in April, the new Consolidated Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme promises more flexibility to workers and employers. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, says it will help Pacific workers access longer-term visas and the opportunity to train in new industries. But the former Kiribati president, Anote Tong, says the scheme lacks pathways to permanent residency that his people need in the face of climate change. Mr. Tong says seasonal work was never intended for settlement, but the skills learned could help pave the way for a new visa category he's proposing.
From first-hand experience, I know how difficult it is to go into a new cultural environment. And so that is part of overcoming the problem. So it would be part of the preparation. Whether that develops in time, hopefully so, into a permanent migration scheme, it would depend on how the relations develop.
He says time is running out to provide Kiribati with more opportunities for permanent settlement in Australia.
We are now faced with the problem, with the challenges of having to adapt to climate change. You know, it seems such a win-win option.
Working alongside Anote Tong is Aka Rimon, a former foreign secretary for the Kiribati government. Now researching climate displacement at the Australian National University, she says Kiribati needs to be given options before climate displacement worsens.
We're going to have to relocate at some point in time. And because we don't want there to be a rush process, I guess for us looking into Australia as a leader in the Pacific, let's look at the Pacific Labour Scheme, which has come a long way, and except that it's still a multi-visa program when there is not an opportunity yet to sort of graduate the program into a long-term permanent migration scheme.
Ms. Raymond says climate displacement is not just a question of rising sea levels either.
Droughts, it's in the form of water scarcity, you know, it's in the form of food security. So it may not be waves climbing over the islands directly, but the impacts are already happening. And that's something that I believe is a misconception from outside Kiribati. You know, why are you moving now when the waves are, you're not
sinking yet.
Victoria Stead, a research fellow at Deakin University, is also concerned the new Pacific Labour Scheme doesn't go far enough. By combining the seasonal work program with the Pacific Labour Scheme, which offers multi-year visas, the Australian government is hoping short-term labourers will be able to pick up other work if they want to stay longer. But Dr. Stead says because it will depend on the support of an Australian employer, that's unlikely to happen.
Effectively, entirely at their discretion to elect who they might offer that ongoing work for. And we know that when workers, employers have that level of control and decision-making capacity over the employment conditions and the reappointments or extension of appointments of workers, that acts as a really powerful disincentive to those workers to be able to, say, complain or raise grievances about unfair conditions.
Dr. Stead agrees there should be more pathways to permanent residency for the Pacific in response to climate displacement, but she says Australia shouldn't tie this to the labour market.
The seasonal worker program is not an act of Australian benevolence to the Pacific. It is a labour scheme through which Pacific Islanders are working, and they should have entitlements to work in ways that are not exploitative, that come with meaningful protections. I think this idea of these schemes as developmentalist and as acts of benevolence, it's actually really dangerous and really slippery, and it's a framing that I think we need to push back on quite vigorously.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade didn't respond to requests for comment on how the new labour scheme will ensure more long-term visas are granted. The former Kiribati Foreign Secretary, Aka Rimon, says another concern is that skills-based visas could result in a brain drain for the country. But she says people deserve to have the option. For herself, Ms. Remont says she won't be leaving Kiribati no matter how bad things get.
Mackenzie Smith reporting there. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And a recap of our top stories here on the show today. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manessa Sogavare faces a vote of no confidence later on today after unrest in Solomon Islands. The New Caledonia will this week go to their third and final vote on a referendum for independence, but CANAC leaders have asked to postpone that poll. And a rugby revolution in Melbourne, the Rebels Super W team are set to become the first women's side to be paid when their season starts next year. But that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. Thank you so much for your company. I will be back tomorrow, same time, 6 a.m. PNG time. But right now, you're headed towards 5 minutes of the news.